You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Kia ora, Alan. How are you this afternoon?
I'm very well, thank you, Shamina.
Fantastic.
And last week we started off with a musical recommendation from me, if you recall.
So
if
yes, we did.
If you'll indulge me again.
Oh, go for it. What would you like to share with us today?
Well, Stephen Wilson's got a new album out this week.
Mm-hmm.
He's from Porcupine Tree. And the recommendation is a song called The Raven Who Refused to Sing. And if you go to YouTube and look that up, and if you can watch that from go to woe without tearing up, then you're probably a better person than I am. It's an extraordinary song. So
we should,
and a wonderful video.
We should check it out, see if we've got it in the system, see if we can play it later today. Anyway, the first story that you have for us today is about how Queen Victoria sent the first official transatlantic telegraph in 1858 to US President Buchanan. So tell me about this.
Absolutely. And that was today, in fact, in 1858, which is why we are talking about it today, I guess. So I guess it just shows how we can sort of contrast what we take for granted today with the very early days of communication. And as you rightly said, in 1858, Queen Victoria sent the US President James Buchanan a telegraph, and this was across the newly laid cable across the Atlantic Ocean. And the telegraph itself was 99 words long, or 509 letters or characters, I guess, which is about 3.5 tweets these days. And basically it was sort of congratulating him upon the cable being finished, etc., all in very sort of florid language. The interesting thing about it was that they started transmitting this at 10:50 a.m. in the morning, and they finished transmitting this at 4:30 a.m. the next morning. So
wow, that so is a long.
That's
long
basically
process.
2 minutes per letter. So you sort of think of the people that they're you know, waiting in the States for each sort of individual letter, guessing what the next letter's going to be, presumably.
Oh my god,
fun even.
The suspense.
I know. And so this was obviously sent by Morse code, which was developed sort of about 10 years earlier by Samuel Morse. The first commercial telegraph was 1838, and the first telegraph itself was about 1816, the first demonstration of a telegraph, which seemed to me quite early. I was quite surprised by that date of 1816. But, you know, contrast that now with the fact that a certain yellow-haired, short-fingered vulgarian can get his views out to the rest of the world essentially instantaneously. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing these days, but it is a thing.
Yeah, it is faster and, you know, better access, always a good thing, you know?
And the really sad thing about the whole original transatlantic cable was that 3 weeks after Queen Victoria sent that message and was replied to by James Buchanan, the signals were getting a bit weak or something, so some guy at the end of it turned the voltage up and fried the whole thing. So it lasted a whole 3 weeks, laying a transatlantic cable, and it was gone after 3 weeks.
So they laid this cable one specific thing, or
they'd sent some messages on it beforehand just to test it out and everything, but this was the first official use of the cable, and it was going to be used for transatlantic communication, but 3 weeks later, blah. So then they went and just did another one, etc., but boy, what an expense for 3 weeks worth of telegraphs at 2 minutes per letter.
I'm blown away that they even had the technology to lay a cable like that. I mean, this is, we're talking the time when sailing ships were still the main form of transport. So they,
yeah, I think these were steamships that laid it, I think, but don't quote me. My nautical expertise is a bit thin, but yeah. But it is, yeah, and you're right, it's extraordinary for the time, and just how far we've come is amazing too.
So what would the cable be made of?
Well, apparently, it used a thing called gutta percha, which is a type of rubber. And so the whole thing had to sort of come together at the right time, because they didn't have those sort of polymeric materials that we've got now. And so they had to use this natural rubber. And so therefore that came from Malaya or whatever, all the plantations out there. So, and you know, it was around about that time that they were starting using this sort of thing. So that waterproofed the whole thing. So, you know, it was a combination of technologies, I guess, because, you know, you had your electricity, obviously, you had the Morse code, you had the waterproofing, etc. So just that's the way that science works. You know, things just come together at the one time, and it takes, you know, one person to see the possibilities of putting all these things together. So, you know, that's obviously what happened then.
Fascinating. That's awesome.
Yeah, pretty cool.
And so moving on to a slightly more, a slightly darker subject, I suppose. So we've got new research that shows cancer patients who turn to alternative medicine are 2.5 times more likely to die. So tell me about this study.
Okay, so this was published, I think, last week in the Journal of the National Cancer Cancer Institute by some workers at Yale University, so a very prestigious university in the States. And as you correctly say, the key finding of the study was that people who turn to solely alternative medicine were 2.5 times more likely to die than those who were treated with what we would call, or what people call sadly, conventional medicine, what I just call medicine. So the way that it worked, the study involved 281 patients who, when they had a diagnosis of cancer, relied solely on alternative medicine. Okay. And these were then compared with 560 patients who chose the more conventional route. So the cancers that were of interest were breast cancer, prostate cancer, lung cancer, and colorectal cancer. So they, the four sort of biggest killing cancers in the States. And the alternative medicine people chose whatever alternative medicines they had, and the conventional medicines. So they were treated using chemotherapy, radiotherapy, surgery, hormone therapy, those sorts of things. So your conventional treatments. And in all cases, for each type of cancer, you were at least 2.5 times more likely to die if you just use the alternative rather than the conventional, with the big one being breast cancer, which was 5 times more likely. So if you refuse conventional treatment with breast cancer, you're 5 times more likely to die. Really interestingly, they studied the makeup of the alternative medicine group, and they found that they were more likely to be younger, female, interestingly higher income and education, and also have breast cancer. So those were basically the people who were undergoing the alternative, which, yeah, I found that quite surprising, particularly the higher income and education sort of thing. But yeah. Well, each their own, I guess. And finally, they're looking at the 5-year survival rates for people who were diagnosed with cancer. And with the alternative medicine, the 5-year survival rate was about 55%. And with the conventional, it was about 78%. And again, breast cancer was a particular standout there. It was 58% using alternative versus 87% using conventional methods. So now you look at the comments on this, and there's a depressingly large number of people who are just saying, oh, this is all big pharma. The study was funded, well, it's published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, so they're obviously employed by the National Cancer Institute. No, they're not. They're employed by Yale University. The study was obviously funded by Big Pharma because, you know, chemotherapy is just developed to make you dependent on the stuff that doesn't work. And yeah, it really is sad. I don't know where people get these ideas from. There's an enormous amount of time and energy that goes into developing drugs. Obviously, okay, we want to create drugs that make people well, that cure these horrible diseases. Shit, you know, we want to get rid of cancer. It would be fantastic if we could. And the reason that you make any advances at all in that respect is because of people beavering away in the laboratories and doing these studies. Now, when you are trying to come up with a cancer drug, you've got to go through FDA approval, Federal Drug Administration in the States. And that process is extraordinarily long, extraordinarily torturous. There's 3 stages to it. If you get through all 3 stages, then you can then license your drug for use. You get patent protection on that for X number of years. I think it's 7, I can't remember. But to get to stage 3, you have invested a hell of a lot of money in doing this. Okay, so it would be great if it was totally altruistic, but you know, people have got to make money. They've got to cover their costs somewhere along the line. So, you know, that's why you end up having to pay for drugs. And some drugs are ridiculously expensive just because of their sheer nature, okay? Some drugs are very, very simple to make, very cheap to make. And some drugs, like, you know, something like aspirin, that's very easy. You can make that in a first-year laboratory. But, you know, the drugs that are coming out today, they're sort of biologically derived drugs. They're extraordinarily expensive things. And, you know, that's why the treatment costs are so high. And that's why, thank goodness, we've got a thing called Pharmac, which, you know, I guess shields New Zealanders to a certain extent from those high prices, probably at the expense of not funding particular horribly expensive drugs where cheaper ones will be just as efficacious, potentially anyway. Okay, so but I mean, that's getting away from the point a little bit. The point is that don't rely on alternative medicine, so-called alternative medicine, you know. In my view, there's no such thing as alternative medicine. There's medicine and there's, and that's it, you know.
So we talked a little bit about this on the breakfast show this morning.
Yeah.
And producer Sarah, she raised a point in that. So we have a naturopath who comes to visit us every Monday morning on the breakfast show, who tries to, you know, she's not saying this is an alternative to the established medical treatment, that it is complementary.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Now, that's, and that's probably what the way that they're trying to save themselves, that they talk about complementary medicine, which is in concert with the sort of your chemotherapy and stuff like that. And, you know, of course, if you're undergoing chemotherapy and stuff, it's a good idea to eat well, you know. It's a good idea to look after yourself. That's just sort of common sense. And these so-called complementary approaches, you know, who's to say that they're giving any better outcomes than what would have happened in their absence? So,
right, yeah, because if you're taking them together, then
you don't really know what would happen.
Yeah,
of course, that, ladies and gentlemen, is the trouble with medical research, is that you cannot do the control experiment. You can never look at what would have happened in the absence of that particular treatment. You're dealing with a single person. You're giving them a drug, and they either get better or they die. Mm. You have no idea what would have happened in the absence of that drug. You can't do the control experiment, and that's why medical research is so fraught and so controversial, I guess, which is why studies like these are done. And as soon as they are put out, then you get an enormous amount of feedback. I'm sure people are, you know, tweeting or whatever about this right now. But that is the sad fact of the matter.
Mm. I mean, sorry, just one of the arguments I've heard from these alternative medicine people is that back in the Middle Ages, people used urine and things, and they thought that was the correct medicine, you know, in terms of treating like black plague and things like that.
Yep.
And they argue that what's the difference between then and now and us using, say, chemotherapy? They could say that in the future they might look back at us and think what we're doing is archaic. But I would almost argue that we experiment with alternative medicine, or we experiment with all these random things like drinking urine or whatever you want to do in your spare time.
Yeah.
And we take what works from those medicines and turn that into actual medicine.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I completely agree. I mean, you know, a lot of drugs are derived from plant material. So, you know, you, for example, aspirin. So that comes from willow bark originally, and that was an ancient treatment. People would boil up willow bark when they had, you know, the flu or whatever, any sort of inflammatory sort of things, and that would cure that. And eventually they found out that this thing salicylic acid was present in willow bark, and that's essentially what aspirin is. So, you know, I'm not saying there's nothing out there in nature that can't be used, you know. That's just not the case. But I mean, there was a guy in the Herald on Saturday, I think, who is treating cancer patients with leeches and claiming that you know, he's getting great results and people are being cured of cancer, and he says he can't do the clinical trials of these because it costs too much, or some, you know, some nonsense like that. Hell, if you've got a cure for cancer, man, then, you know, you should be getting out there and telling the world and giving us proof. Because, you know, it's one of the most important things. If you could cure cancer, you know, you would be a fantastic person, you know. You would go down in history.
Mm. And something else that Mikey raised when we were talking about it this morning on the show was about how, I mean, and I think this is also a really important distinction that is made, and where some of the dislike or skepticism around, you know, the establishment of medical research and people being attracted to alternative medicine is this idea of big pharma, and that bad science happens, therefore be suspicious of all sort of expensive drugs that are created in labs, because there is a lot of money around medicine, and, you know, we do know that bad science does happen, that things get published in dodgy journals and so on and so forth.
I agree.
But it's important to distinguish that from all of the
absolutely. And the fact that the FDA process is so torturous means that no bad science is going to get through. Well, I say no and then immediately think of thalidomide. But then, of course, you know about thalidomide. No, no.
Tell us.
So that was a drug that was used as a morning sickness prevention drug in the early 60s. And they found out too late that it led to, in fact, a horrible birth defect. So kids were being born without limbs. And it was just horrific. And it was all down to the fact that the actual molecule could exist as mirror images like hands. And one of the mirror images was a good molecule and it would cure morning sickness. The other one led to the birth defects, and they didn't know this at the time. So yes, some things do get through, but for good, you know, and there's always side effects to drugs as well. There always are. You know, you look on any drug label, there's side effects may include blah 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 blah. But the process that it's got to go through means that it's so extraordinarily unlikely that just straight crap science is going to get through this process. It's not going to happen.
I guess like these instances of where the process, where the very rigorous process has not worked, are very much, you know, they shouldn't be used to like be extrapolated to therefore
exactly
for people to see the whole of medical research that does exist, or all research for that, all scientific research for that matter, that it's not, oh, well, this is therefore evidence that the whole system is fucked.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I couldn't have put that better myself. Yeah.
So I assume chemotherapy, don't you mean mustard gas, is a text from a listener. Don't know what that means, but...
Yeah, well, chemotherapy necessarily involves interactions with our DNA. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what it's all about. So the trick with chemotherapy is to specifically target cancerous DNA. So you're looking at specifically targeting cancerous cells. Now, we can't do that absolutely yet. When we can, cancer will be gone. If you can specifically target a cancerous cell, then we've got the chemicals that can kill that, okay? Now, the body is brilliant at recognizing, cells, but we're not quite so good at that yet. We can't yet quite, you know, make the molecules that are going to do that. But we're making, you know, big advances in that region. So,
right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think that's also the thing as well. It's that it's not that the current established medical treatments for cancer that doctors or scientists are saying these work and these are the most robust ways of treating cancer, because there's so many cases in which they don't work and that people are dying.
Yes, yep.
But that this is the thing that is proven to help more people than anything else.
Indeed, and you'll never get a doctor saying this will cure you of cancer. because you can't say that with certainty. But what you can say with certainty is it will increase your chances of surviving.
And so just very quickly, we'll touch on our last topic for today. So a mysterious pigment has often been used to spot fake art. Tell me about this.
Yeah, indeed. This is a really interesting story, actually. So if you want to spot a fake painting, how do you go about spotting the fake painting? So one way is to do an analysis of the pigments, because if you're looking at some painting, you know, painting by, you know, Leonardo da Vinci or somewhere like that from the, you know, 15th, 16th century, then they would use particular pigments at that stage, which were only around at that particular time. Is it a fake? Is it a forgery? Then if it is, you know, that it would have been painted in the 20th century and they would have used different stuff. So you've got to analyze somehow the pigments in the painting to see whether it's a real thing or not. And you need, therefore, a non-destructive method of being able to do that. Okay, you don't want to pick bits of, well, you can pick little bits of paint, little flecks of paint off the painting, but ideally you
don't
want
to touch it.
No, you don't want to touch it. So there's a method called Raman spectroscopy, and this involves looking at the vibrations in a molecule. Okay, it's very, very detailed. We're not going to go into it, but as simple as that, what you basically do is you shine light on it, and from the way that the light interacts, you can figure out what the molecules in the pigment are, basically. And in order to do that, you need some kind of standard, okay? So that's the important thing, is the standard, the whole standard. So if you know what a particular pigment looks like, the signature of a particular pigment when you shine light on it, then you can say, if you look at another sample of it and you get that same signature, then you can say with certainty that that pigment's present in the other painting, okay? So there's this thing called Indian yellow, which is a painting that was a pigment that was much beloved by J.M.W. Turner, that famous English sort of landscape painter. sort of a bright yellow colour. And it was called Indian yellow because apparently it came from the dried urine of Indian cows that had only been fed mango leaves. So they say, anyway. But it was a particular, or it consists of a particular molecule called eusanthic acid. And it was much beloved of Turner and sort of those of his ilk around about that time, but it was first discovered in the 14th century. Now, in the 19th century, they started making artificial dyes, and these natural, so-called natural ones from the cow urine and everything, obviously horribly expensive because, you know, there's not too many, you know, Indian cows that get fed only on mango leaves. But William Perkin came along and started making artificial dyes, which were way cheaper. And so he made a yellow colour called tartrazine, which is in food colouring and stuff like that. Now, the two colours, the tartrazine and the Indian yellow, the two molecules are very, very different molecules. And by shining light on them and looking at their signatures, you can figure out which one's which, okay? So what they've just discovered is that they mixed it up way back when. So the stuff that they thought was authentic Indian yellow was, in fact, the tartrazine. And so the standard that they'd used for Indian yellow for all of these years was, in fact, the standard for tartrazine. And so they've got it horribly, horribly wrong. So all of the paintings that have been tested using this technique,
right,
which were said to be, oh, they, you know, they must
be
real.
This is authentic because of these things.
So now it looks really like they're not.
So do they have to go around to museums all over the world and do these tests just to make sure that they don't have a fraudulent painting hung up on in the space of the actual legit thing?
Exactly. And so there's at least three works of art that they've discovered that very probably are now forgeries. Where they thought that they were kosher. So I think watch the space. I think it's a fascinating paper, this, and it really has got sort of quite enormous ramifications for the art world. So
it's so interesting.
There goes chemistry for you.
Yeah.
Chemistry
can be fun. Cool. Well, thanks for joining us again this week, Alan.
Not a problem, Shamina.
That was Dear Science.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.